Vince said what?
A small thing, Deb, a detail. Who knows what it means?
Nobody will ever know if you don't say it, Dexter.
There seems to be no blood left with the body. No blood at all.
Deborah was quiet for a minute, thinking. Not a reverent pause, not like me, just thinking.
Okay, she said at last. I give up. What does it mean?
Too soon to tell, I said. But you think it means something.
It meant a strange lightheadedness. It meant an itch to find out more about this killer. It meant an appreciative chuckle from the dark passenger, who should have been quiet so soon after the priest. But that was all rather tough to explain to Deborah, wasn't it? So I just said, "It might, Deb. Who really knows?" She looked at me hard for half a moment, then shrugged.
All right, she said. Anything else?
Oh, a great deal, I said. Very nice blade work. The cuts are close to surgical. Unless they find something in the hotel, which no one expects, the body was killed somewhere else and dumped here.
Where?
Very good question. Half of police work is asking the right questions.
The other half is answering, she told me.
Well then, nobody knows where yet, Deb, and I certainly don't have all the forensic data.
But you're starting to get a feel for this one, she said.
I looked at her. She looked back. I had developed hunches before. I had a small reputation for it. My hunches were often quite good. And why shouldn't they be? I often know how the killers are thinking. I think the same way. Of course, I was not always right. Sometimes I was very wide of the mark. It wouldn't look good if I was always right. And I didn't want the cops to catch every serial killer out there. Then what would I do for a hobby? But this one. Which way should I go with this so very interesting escapade?
Tell me, Dexter, Deborah urged. Have you got any guesses about this?
Possibly, I said. It's a little early yet.
Well, Morgan, said Lagerta from behind us. We both turned. I see you're dressed for real police work.
Something about Lagerta's tone was like a slap on the face. Deborah stiffened.
Detective, she said. Did you find anything?
She said it in a tone that already knew the answer. A cheap shot. But it missed. Lagerta waved a hand airily.
They are only putas, she said, looking hard at Deb's cleavage, so very prominent in her hooker suit. Just hookers. The important thing here is to keep the press from getting hysterical.
She shook her head slowly as if in disbelief and looked up.
Considering what you can do with gravity, that should be easy.
And she winked at me and strolled off, over toward the perimeter, where Captain Matthews was talking with great dignity to Jerry Gonzalez from Channel 7.
Bitch,
Deborah said. I'm sorry, Debs. Would you prefer me to say, we'll show her, or should I go with, I told you so? She glared at me.
God damn it, Dexter, she said. I really want to be the one to find this guy.
And as I thought about that no blood at all, so did I. I really wanted to find him, too.
Chapter 4
I took my boat out that night after work, to get away from Deb's questions, and to sort through what I was feeling. Feeling. Me. Feeling. What a concept. I nosed my whaler slowly out the canal, thinking nothing, a perfect Zen state, moving at idle speed past the large houses, all separated from each other by high hedges and chain-link fences. I threw an automatic big wave and bright smile to all the neighbors out in their yards that grew neatly up to the canal's seawall. Kids playing on the manicured grass. Mom and Dad barbecuing, or lounging, or polishing the barbed wire. Hawk eyes on the kids. I waved to everybody. Some of them even waved back. They knew me, had seen me go by before, always cheerful, a big hello for everybody. He was such a nice man. Very friendly. I can't believe he did those horrible things. I opened up the throttle when I cleared the canal, heading out the channel and then southeast toward Cape Florida. The wind in my face and the taste of the salt spray helped clear my head, made me feel clean and a little fresher. I found it a great deal easier to think. Part of it was the calm and peace of the water, And another part was that in the best tradition of Miami watercraft, most of the other boaters seemed to be trying to kill me. I found that very relaxing. I was right at home. This is my country. These are my people. All day long at work, I'd gotten little forensic updates. Around lunchtime, the story broke national. The lid was coming off the hooker murders after the grisly discovery at the Cacique Motel. Channel 7 had done a masterful job of presenting all the hysterical horror of body parts in a dumpster without actually saying anything about them. As Detective Laguerta had shrewdly observed, these were only hookers. But once public pressure started to rise from the media, they might as well be senators' daughters. And so the department began to gear up for a long spell of defensive maneuvering, knowing exactly what kind of heart-rending twaddle would be coming from the brave and fearless foot soldiers of the Fifth Estate. Deb had stayed at the scene until the captain began to worry about authorizing too much overtime, and then she'd been sent home. She started calling me at 2 in the afternoon to hear what I'd discovered, which was very little. They'd found no traces of anything at the motel. There were so many tire tracks in the parking lot that none were distinct. No prints or traces in the dumpster, on the bags, or on the body parts. Everything USDA inspection clean. The one big clue of the day was the left leg. As Angel had noticed, the right leg had been sectioned into several neat pieces, cut at the hip, knee, and ankle. But the left leg was not. It was a mere 2 sections, neatly wrapped. "Aha," said Detective Laguerta, lady genius. Somebody had interrupted the killer, surprised him, startled him so he did not finish the cut. He panicked when he was seen, and she directed all her effort at finding that witness. There was one small problem with Laguerta's theory of interruption, a tiny little thing, perhaps splitting hairs, but the entire body had still been meticulously cleaned and wrapped, presumably after it had been cut up. And then it had been transported carefully to the dumpster, apparently with enough time and focus for the killer to make no mistakes and leave no traces. Either nobody pointed this out to Laguerta, or, wonder of wonders, could it be that nobody else had noticed? Possible. So much of police work is routine, fitting details into patterns, and if the pattern was brand new, the investigation could seem like 3 blind men examining an elephant with a microscope. But since I was neither blind nor hampered by routine, it had seemed far more likely to me that the killer was simply unsatisfied. Plenty of time to work, but this was the 5th murder in the same pattern. Was it getting boring? Simply chopping up the body? Was our boy searching for something else, something different, some new direction, an untried twist? I could almost feel his frustration. To have come so far, all the way to the end, sectioning the leftovers for gift wrapping, and then the sudden realization, this isn't it. Something is just not right. Coitus interruptus. It wasn't fulfilling him this way anymore. He needed a different approach. He was trying to express something and hadn't found his vocabulary yet. And in my personal opinion, I mean if it was me, this would make him very frustrated and very likely to look further for the answer. Soon. But let Laguerta look for a witness. There would be none. This was a cold, careful monster, and absolutely fascinating to me. And what should I do about that fascination? I was not sure, so I had retreated to my boat to think. A Donzi cut across my bow at 70 miles per hour, only inches away. I waved happily and returned to the present. I was approaching Stiltsville, the mostly abandoned collection of old stilt homes in the water near Cape Florida. I nosed into a big circle, going nowhere, and let my thoughts move back into that same slow arc. What would I do? I needed to decide now, before I got too helpful for Deborah. I could help her solve this, absolutely, no one better. Nobody else was even moving in the right direction. But did I want to help? Did I want this killer arrested? Or did I want to find him and stop him myself? Beyond this, oh, nagging little thought, did I even want him to stop? What would I do?
To my right, I could just see Elliott Key in the last light of the day. And as always, I remembered my camping trip there with Harry Morgan, my foster father, the good cop.
You're different, Dexter.
Yes, Harry, I certainly am.
But you can learn to control that difference and use it constructively.
All right, Harry, if you think I should.
How?
And he told me.
There is no starry sky anywhere like the starry sky in South Florida when you are 14 and camping out with Dad. Even if he's only your foster dad, and even if the sight of all those stars merely fills you with a kind of satisfaction, emotion being out of the question, you don't feel it. That's part of the reason you're here. The fire has died down and the stars are exceedingly bright, and foster dear old Dad has been quiet for some time, taking small sips on the old-fashioned hip flask he has pulled from the outside flap of his pack. And he's not very good at this, not like so many other cops, not really a drinker. But it's empty now, and it's time for him to say his piece, if he's ever going to say it.
You're different, Dexter, he says.
I look away from the brightness of the stars. Around the small and sandy clearing, the last glow of the fire is making shadows. Some of them trickle across Harry's face. He looks strange to me, like I've never seen him before. Determined, unhappy, a little dazed.
What do you mean, Dad?
He won't look at me.
The Billups say Buddy has disappeared, he says.
Noisy little creep, he was barking all night. Mom couldn't sleep.
Mom needed her sleep, of course. Dying of cancer requires plenty of rest, and she wasn't getting it with that awful little dog across the street yapping at every leaf that blew down the sidewalk.
I found the grave, Harry says. There are a lot of bones in there, Dexter, not just Buddy's.
There's very little to say here. I carefully pull at a handful of pine needles and wait for Harry.
How long have you been doing this?
I search Harry's face, then look out across the clearing to the beach. Our boat is there, moving gently with the surge of the water. The lights of Miami are off to the right, a soft white glow. I can't figure out where Harry is going, what he wants to hear. But he is my straight arrow foster dad. The truth is usually a good idea with Harry. He always knows, or he finds out.
1.5 years, I say.
Harry nods. Why did you start?
A very good question, and certainly beyond me at 14. I kind of had to, I tell him. Even then, so young but so smooth.
Do you hear a voice? He wants to know. Something or somebody telling you what to do, and you had to do it?
I say with 14-year-old eloquence. Not exactly.
Tell me, Harry says.
Oh, for a moon. A good fat moon. Something bigger to look at. I clutch another fistful of pine needles. My face is hot, as if Dad has asked me to talk about sex dreams, which, in a way... feel something, I say. Inside. Watching me. Maybe laughing? But not really a voice, just...
An eloquent teenaged shrug. But it seems to make sense to Harry.
And this something.
It makes you kill things.
High overhead, a slow fat jet crawls by.
Doesn't make me, I say. Just makes it seem like a good idea.
Have you ever wanted to kill something else? Something bigger than a dog?
I try to answer, but there is something in my throat. I clear it.
Yes, I say.
A person?
Nobody in particular, Dad. Just...
I shrug again. Why didn't you?
I thought you wouldn't like it, you and Mom.
That's all that stopped you.
I didn't want you, mad at me. Disappointed.
I steal a glance at Harry. He is looking at me, not blinking.
Is that why we took this trip, Dad? To talk about this?
Yes,
Harry says. We need to get you squared away. Squared away, oh yes, a completely Harry idea of how life is lived, with hospital corners and polished shoes. And even then I knew, needing to kill something every now and then would pretty much, sooner or later, get in the way of being squared away. How? I say. And he looks at me long and hard, and then he nods when he sees that I am with him step for step. Good boy, he says. Now. And in spite of saying now, it is a very long time before he speaks again. I watch the lights on a boat as it goes past, maybe 200 yards out from our little beach. Over the sound of their motor, a radio is blasting Cuban music. Now, Harry says again, and I look at him. But he is looking away across the dying fire, off into the future over there somewhere. It's like this, he says. I listen carefully. This is what Harry says when he is giving you a higher order truth. When he showed me how to throw a curveball and how to throw a left hook, it's like this, he would say, and it always was, just like that. I'm getting old, Dexter. He waited for me to object, but I didn't, and he nodded. I think people understand things different when they get older, he says. It's not a question of getting soft, or seeing things in the gray areas instead of black and white. I really believe I'm just understanding things different. Better. He looks at me. Harry's look. Tough love with blue eyes. Okay, I say. 10 years ago I would have wanted you in an institution somewhere, he says, and I blink. That almost hurts, except I've thought of it myself. Now, he says, I think I know better. I know what you are, and I know you're a good kid. No, I say, and it comes out very soft and weak, but Harry hears. Yes, he says firmly, you're a good kid, Dex. I know that. I know it. Almost to himself now, for effect maybe, and then his eyes lock onto mine. Otherwise you wouldn't care what I thought or what Mom thought. You'd just do it. You can't help it, I know that, because... He stops and just looks at me for a moment. It's very uncomfortable for me. What do you remember from before? He asked. You know, before we took you in. That still hurts, but I really don't know why. I was only 3. Nothing. Good, he says. Nobody should remember that. And as long as he lives, that will be the most he ever says about it. But even though you don't remember, Dex, it did things to you. Those things make you what you are. I've talked to some people about this. And strangest of strange, he gives me a very small, almost shy, Harry smile. I've been expecting this. What happened to you when you were a little kid has shaped you. I've tried to straighten that out, but... He shrugs. It was too strong, too much. It got into you too early, and it's going to stay there. It's going to make you want to kill, and you can't help that. You can't change that. But, he says. And he looks away again to see what, I can't tell. But you can channel it. Control it. Choose. His words come so carefully now, more careful than I've ever heard him talk. Choose what, or who, you kill. And he gave me a smile unlike any I had ever seen before, a smile as bleak and dry as the ashes of our dying fire. There are plenty of people who deserve it, Dex. And with those few little words, he gave a shape to my whole life, my everything, my who and what I am, the wonderful, all-seeing, all-knowing man, Harry, my dad. If only I was capable of love... How I would have loved Harry. So long ago now, Harry long dead. But his lessons had lived on. Not because of any warm and gooey emotional feelings I had. Because Harry was right. I'd proved that over and over. Harry knew, and Harry taught me well. Be careful, Harry said. And he taught me to be careful as only a cop could teach a killer. To choose carefully among those who deserved it, to make absolutely sure Then tidy up. Leave no traces. And always avoid emotional involvement. It can lead to mistakes. Being careful went beyond the actual killing, of course. Being careful meant building a careful life, too. Compartmentalize, socialize, imitate life. All of which I had done, so very carefully. I was a near-perfect hologram, above suspicion, beyond reproach, and beneath contempt. A neat and polite monster, the boy next door. Even Deborah was at least half-fooled half the time. Of course, she believed what she wanted to believe, too. Right now, she believed I could help her solve these murders, jumpstart her career, and catapult her out of her Hollywood sex suit and into a tailored business suit. And she was right, of course. I could help her. But I didn't really want to, because I enjoyed watching this other killer work and felt some kind of aesthetic connection or emotional involvement. Well, there it was. I was in clear violation of the code of Harry. I nosed the boat back toward my canal. It was full dark now, but I steered by a radio tower a few degrees to the left of my home water. So be it. Harry had always been right. He was right now. "Don't get emotionally involved," Harry had said. So I wouldn't. I would help Deb.
Chapter 5. The next morning it was raining, and the traffic was crazy like it always is in Miami when it rains. Some drivers slowed down on the slick roads. That made others furious, and they leaned on their horns, screamed out their windows, and accelerated out onto the shoulder, fishtailing wildly past the slowpokes and waving their fists. At the Lejeune on-ramp, a huge dairy truck had roared onto the shoulder and hit a van full of kids from a Catholic school. The dairy truck flipped over, and now five young girls in plaid wool skirts were sitting in a huge puddle of milk with dazed looks on their faces. Traffic nearly stopped for an hour. One kid was airlifted to Jackson Hospital. The others sat in the milk in their uniforms and watched the grown-ups scream at each other. I inched along placidly, listening to the radio. Apparently, the police were hot on the trail of the Tamiami Butcher. There were no specifics available, but Captain Matthews got a lovely soundbite. He made it seem like he would personally make the arrest as soon as he finished his coffee. I finally got off onto surface roads and went only a little faster. I stopped at a donut shop not too far from the airport. I bought an apple fritter and a cruller, but the apple fritter was gone almost before I got back into the car. I have a very high metabolism. It comes with living the good life. The rain had stopped by the time I got to work. The sun shone and steam rose from the pavement as I walked into the lobby, flashed my credentials, and went upstairs. Deb was already waiting for me. She did not look happy this morning. Of course, she does not look happy very often anymore. She's a cop, after all, and most of them can't manage the trick at all. Too much time on duty, trying not to look human. It leaves their faces stuck. "Deb," I said. I put the crisp white pastry bag on my desk. "Where were you last night?" she said. Very sour, as I'd expected. Soon those frown lines would turn permanent, ruining a wonderful face, deep blue eyes alive with intelligence, and small upturned nose with just a dash of freckles framed by black hair. Beautiful features, at the moment spattered with about 7 pounds of cheap makeup. I looked at her with fondness. She was clearly coming from work, dressed today in a lacy bra, bright pink spandex shorts, and gold high heels. "Never mind me," I said. "Where were you?" She flushed. She hated to wear anything but clean-pressed blues. "I tried to call you," she said. "Sorry," I said. "Yeah, sure." I sat down in my chair and didn't speak. Deb likes to unload on me. That's what family is for. "Why were you so anxious to talk to me?" "They're shutting me out," she said. She opened my donut bag and looked inside. "What did you expect?" I said. "You know how Laguerta feels about you." She pulled the crawler out of the bag and savaged it. "I expect," she said, mouthful, "to be in on this, like the captain said." "You don't have any seniority," I said, "or any political smarts." She crumpled the bag and threw it at my head. She missed. "God damn it, Dexter," she said. You know damned well I deserve to be in homicide instead of... She snapped her bra strap and waved a hand at her skimpy costume. This bullshit! I nodded. Although on you it looks good, I said. She made an awful face, rage and disgust competing for space. I hate this, she said. I can't do this much longer, or I swear I'll go nuts. It's a little soon for me to have the whole thing figured out, Deb. Shit, she said. Whatever else you could say about police work, it was ruining Deborah's vocabulary. She gave me a cold, hard cop look, the first I'd ever had from her. It was Harry's look, the same eyes, same feeling of looking right through you to the truth. Don't bullshit me, Dex, she said. All you have to do half the time is see the body and you know who did it. I never asked you how you do that, but if you have any hunches on this one, I want them. She kicked out savagely and put a small dent in my metal desk. God damn it, I want out of this stupid outfit.
And we'd all love to see that, Morgan, came a deep and phony voice from behind her in the doorway.
I looked up. Vince Masuoka was smiling in at us. You wouldn't know what to do, Vince, Deb told him. He smiled bigger, that bright fake textbook smile. Why don't we try it and find out? In your dreams, Vince, Debbie said, slumping into a pout that I hadn't seen since she was 12. Vince nodded at the crumpled white bag on my desk. It was your turn, goody. What did you bring me? Where is it? Sorry, Vince, I said. Debbie ate your cruller.
I wish, he said with his sharp imitation leer. Then I could eat her jelly roll. You owe me a big donut, Dex, he said.
The only big one you'll ever have, Deborah said.
It's not the size of the donut, it's the skill of the baker, Vince told her.
Please, I said. You two are going to sprain a frontal lobe. It's too early to be this clever.
Aha! Vince said with his terrible fake laugh. Aha ha ha! See you later! He winked. Don't forget my donut.
And he wandered away to his microscope down the hall. So what have you figured out? Deb asked me. Deb believed that every now and then I got hunches. She had reason to believe. Usually my inspired guesses had to do with the brutal wackos who like to hack up some poor slob every few weeks just for the hell of it. Several times, Deborah had seen me put a quick and clean finger on something that nobody else knew was there. She had never said anything, but my sister is a damned good cop, and so she has suspected me of something for quite a while. She doesn't know what. But she knows there is something wrong there, and it bothers the hell out of her every now and then because she does, after all, love me. The last living thing on the earth that does love me. This is not self-pity, but the coldest, clearest self-knowledge. I am unlovable. Following Harry's plan, I've tried to involve myself in other people, in relationships, and even, in my sillier moments, in love. But it doesn't work. Something in me is broken or missing, and sooner or later the other person catches me acting, or one of those nights comes along. I can't even keep pets. Animals hate me. I bought a dog once. It barked and howled at me in a non-stop, no-mind fury for 2 days before I had to get rid of it. I tried a turtle. I touched it once and it wouldn't come out of its shell again. And after a few days of that, it died. Rather than see me or have me touch it again, it died. Nothing else loves me or ever will. Not even, especially, me. I know what I am, and that is not a thing to love. I am alone in the world, all alone, but for Deborah. Except, of course, for the thing inside who does not come out to play too often, and does not actually play with me, but must have somebody else. So as much as I can, I care about her, dear Deborah. It is probably not love, but I would rather she were happy. And she sat there, dear Deborah, looking unhappy. My family, staring at me and not knowing what to say, but coming closer to saying it than ever before. Well, I said, actually,
I knew it! You do have something!
Don't interrupt my trance, Deborah. I'm in touch with the spirit realm.
Spit it out, she said.
It's the interrupted cut, Deb, the left leg.
What about it?
Lagerda thinks the killer was discovered. Got nervous. Didn't finish. Deborah nodded. She had me asking hookers last night if they saw anything. Somebody must have.
Oh, not you too, I said. Think, Deborah. If he was interrupted, too scared to finish.
The wrapping, she blurted. He still spent a lot of time wrapping the body, cleaning up.
She looked surprised.
Shit. After he was interrupted?
I clapped my hands and beamed at her.
Bravo, Miss Marple.
Then it doesn't make sense.
Au contraire. If there is plenty of time, but the ritual is not completed properly, and remember, Deb, the ritual is nearly everything, what's the implication?
Why can't you just tell me, for God's sake? She snapped.
What fun would that be?
She blew out a hard breath. God damn it. All right, Dex, if he wasn't interrupted, but he didn't finish... Shit. The wrapping up part was more important than the cutting?
I took pity on her. No, Deb, think. This is the fifth one. Exactly like all the others. Four left legs cut perfectly. And now number five? I shrugged, raised an eyebrow at her.
Oh, shit, Dexter, how should I know? Maybe he only needed four left legs. Maybe... I don't know, I swear to God, what?
I smiled and shook my head. To me it was so clear. The thrill is gone, Deb. Something just isn't right. It isn't working. Some essential bit of the magic that makes it perfect isn't there.
I was supposed to figure that out.
Somebody should, don't you think? And so he just sort of dribbles to a stop, looking for inspiration and finding none. She frowned.
So he's done. He won't do this again?
I laughed. Oh, my God, no, Deb, just the opposite. If you were a priest, and you truly believed in God, but couldn't find the right way to worship him, what would you do?
Keep trying, she said, until I got it right.
She stared hard.
Jesus, that's what you think? He's going to do it again soon?
It's just a hunch, I said modestly. I could be wrong, but I was sure I was not wrong.
We should be setting up a way to catch him when he does, she said, not looking for a non-existent witness.
She stood and headed out the door.
I'll call later. Bye.
And she was gone. I poked at the white paper bag. There was nothing left inside. Just like me. A clean, crisp outside, and nothing at all on the inside. I folded the bag and placed it in the trash can beside my desk. There was work to do this morning, real official police lab work. I had a long report to type up, accompanying pictures to sort, evidence to file. It was routine stuff, a double homicide that would probably never go to trial, but I like to make sure that whatever I touch is well organized. Besides, this one had been interesting. The blood spatter had been very difficult to read. Between the arterial spurting, the multiple victims, obviously moving around, and the cast-off pattern from what had to be a chainsaw, it had been almost impossible to find an impact site. In order to cover the whole room, I'd had to use two bottles of luminol, which reveals even the faintest of blood spots, and is shockingly expensive at $12 a bottle. I'd actually had to lay out strings to help me figure the primary spatter angles, a technique ancient enough to seem like alchemy. The splat patterns were startling, vivid. There were bright, wild, feral splatters across the walls, furniture, television, towels, bedspreads, curtains, an amazing wild horror of flying blood. Even in Miami, you would think someone would have heard something. Two people being hacked up alive with a chainsaw in an elegant and expensive hotel room, and the neighbors simply turned up their TVs. You may say that dear, diligent Dexter gets carried away in his job, but I like to be thorough, and I like to know where all the blood is hiding. The professional reasons for this are obvious, but not quite as important to me as the personal ones. Perhaps someday, a psychiatrist retained by the state penal system will help me discover exactly why. In any case, the body chunks were very cold by the time we got to the scene, and we would probably never find the guy in the size 7.5 handmade Italian loafer, right-handed and overweight with a terrific backhand. But I had persevered and done a very neat piece of work. I don't do my job to catch the bad guys. Why would I want to do that? No, I do my job to make order out of chaos, to force the nasty bloodstains to behave properly, and then go away. Others may use my work to catch criminals, that's fine by me, but it doesn't matter. If I am ever careless enough to be caught, they will say I'm a sociopathic monster, a sick and twisted demon who was not even human, and they will probably send me to die in Old Sparky with a smug, self-righteous glow. If they ever catch size 7.5, they will say he is a bad man who went wrong because of social forces he was too unfortunate to resist, and he will go to jail for 10 years before they turn him loose with enough money for a suit and a new chainsaw. Every day at work, I understand Harry a little better. Chapter 6. Friday night. Date night in Miami. And believe it or not, date night for Dexter. Oddly enough, I had found somebody. What? Deeply dead Dexter dating debutante Doxies? Sex among the undead? Has my need to imitate life gone all the way to faking orgasms? Breathe easy. Sex never entered into it. After years of dreadful fumbling and embarrassment trying to look normal, I had finally hooked up with the perfect date. Rita was almost as badly damaged as I am. Married too young, she had fought to make it work for 10 years and 2 kids. Her charming life mate had a few small problems. First alcohol, then heroin, believe it or not, and finally crack. He beat her, the brute. Broke furniture, screamed and threw things and made threats. Then raped her. Infected her with some dreadful crack house diseases. All this on a regular basis, and Rita endured, worked, fought him through rehab twice. Then he went after the kids one night, and Rita finally put her foot down. Her face had healed by now, of course, and broken arms and ribs are routine for Miami physicians. Rita was quite presentable, just what the monster ordered. The divorce was final, the brute was locked up, and then, ah, the mysteries of the human mind. Somehow, some why, dear Rita had decided to date again. She was quite sure it was the right thing to do, but as a result of her frequent battery at the hands of the man she loved, she was completely uninterested in sex. Just maybe some masculine company for a while. She had searched for just the right guy. Sensitive, gentle, and willing to wait. Quite a long search, of course. She was looking for some imaginary man who cared more about having someone to talk to and see movies with than someone to have sex with, because she was just not ready for that. Did I say imaginary? Well, yes. Human men are not like that. Most women know this by the time they've had 2 kids and their first divorce. Poor Rita had married too young and too badly to learn this valuable lesson. And as a byproduct of recovering from her awful marriage, instead of realizing that all men are beasts, she had come up with this lovely, romantic picture of a perfect gentleman who would wait indefinitely for her to open slowly like a little flower. Well, really, perhaps such a man existed in Victorian England, when there was a knocking shop on every corner, where he could blow off steam between flowery protestations of frictionless love, but not, to my knowledge, in 21st century Miami. And yet, I could imitate all those things perfectly. And I actually wanted to. I had no interest in a sexual relationship. I wanted a disguise. Rita was exactly what I was looking for. She was, as I say, very presentable. Petite and pert and spunky, a slim athletic figure, short blonde hair and blue eyes. She was a fitness fanatic, spending all her off hours running and biking and so on. In fact, sweating was one of our favorite activities. We had cycled through the Everglades, done 5K runs, and even pumped iron together. And best of all were her 2 children. Aster was 8 and Cody was 5. And they were much too quiet. They would be, of course. Children whose parents frequently attempt to kill each other with the furniture tend to be slightly withdrawn. Any child brought up in a horror zone is, but they can be brought out of it eventually. Look at me. I had endured nameless and unknown horrors as a child, and yet here I was, a useful citizen, a pillar of the community. Perhaps that was part of my strange liking for Astor and Cody, because I did like them, and that made no sense to me. I know what I am, and I understand many things about myself, but one of the few character traits that genuinely mystifies me is my attitude toward children. I like them. They are important to me. They matter. I don't understand it, really. I genuinely wouldn't care if every human in the universe were suddenly to expire, with the possible exception of myself, and maybe Deborah. Other people are less important to me than lawn furniture. I do not, as the shrinks put it so eloquently, have any sense of the reality of others, and I am not burdened with this realization. But kids. Kids are different. I had been dating Rita for nearly a year and a half, and in that time I had slowly and deliberately won over Astor and Cody. I was okay. I wouldn't hurt them. I remembered their birthdays, report card days, holidays. I would come into their house and would do no harm. I could be trusted. Ironic, really, but true. Me, the only man they could really trust. Rita thought it was part of my long, slow courtship of her. Show her that the kids liked me and who knows. But in fact, they mattered to me more than she did. Maybe it was already too late, but I didn't want to see them grow up to be like me. This Friday night, Astor answered the door. She was wearing a large T-shirt that said Rugrats and hung below her knees. Her red hair was pulled back in two pigtails, and she had no expression at all on her small, still face. "Hello, Dexter," she said in her too quiet way. For her, two words were a long conversation. "Good evening, beautiful young lady," I said in my best Lord Mountbatten voice. "May I observe that you are looking very lovely this evening?"
"Okay," she said, holding the door open.
"He's here,"
she said over her shoulder to the darkness around the couch. I stepped past her. Cody was standing behind her, just inside, like he was backing her up, just in case. "Cody," I said. I handed him a roll of Necco wafers. He took them without taking his eyes off me, and simply let his hand drop to his side without looking at the candy. He wouldn't open them until I was gone, and then he would split them with his sister.
"Dexter?"
Rita called from the next room.
"In here," I said. "Can't you teach these children to behave?"
"No," said Cody softly. "A joke." I stared at him. What next? Would he sing someday? Tap dance in the streets? Address the Democratic National Convention? Rita rustled in, fastening a hoop earring. She was rather provocative, considering. She wore a practically weightless light blue silk dress that fell to mid-thigh, and of course her very best New Balance cross-training shoes. I'd never before met, or even heard of, a woman who actually wore comfortable shoes on dates. The enchanting creature. "Hey, handsome," Rita said. "Let me talk to the sitter, and we're out of here." She went into the kitchen, where I heard her going over instructions with the teenage neighbor who did her babysitting, bedtimes, homework, TV do's and don'ts, cell phone number, emergency number, what to do in case of accidental poisoning or decapitation. Cody and Astor still stared at me.
"Are you going to a movie?" Astor asked me.
I nodded. "If we can find one that doesn't make us throw up."
"Yuck," she said.
She made a very small, sour face, and I felt a tiny glow of accomplishment.
"Do you throw up at the movies?" Cody asked.
"Cody,"
Astor said. "Do you?" he insisted. "No," I said, "but I usually want to."
"Let's go," said Rita, sailing in and bending to give each kid a peck on the cheek. "Listen to Alice, bedtime at 9.
"Will you come back?" Cody asked.
"Cody, of course I'll be back," Rita said.
"I meant Dexter," Cody said.
"You'll be asleep," I said. "But I'll wave at you, okay?"
"I won't be asleep," he said grimly.
"Then I'll stop in and play cards with you," I said.
"Really?"
"Absolutely. High-stakes poker. Winner gets to keep the horses."
"Dexter," Rita said, smiling anyway.
"You'll be asleep, Cody. Now good night, kids. Be good." And she took my arm and led me out the door. Honestly, she murmured, you've got those two eating out of your hand. The movie was nothing special. I didn't really want to throw up, but I'd forgotten most of it by the time we stopped at a small place in South Beach for a late-night drink. Rita's idea. In spite of living in Miami for most of her life, she still thought South Beach was glamorous. Perhaps it was all the rollerblades. Or maybe she thought that any place so full of people with bad manners had to be glamorous. In any case, we waited 20 minutes for a small table, and then sat and waited another 20 for service. I didn't mind. I enjoyed watching good-looking idiots looking at each other, a great spectator sport. We strolled along Ocean Boulevard afterward, making pointless conversation, an art at which I excel. It was a lovely night. One corner was chewed off the full moon of a few nights ago when I had entertained Father Donovan. And as we drove back to Rita's South Miami house after our standard evening out, we passed an intersection in one of Coconut Grove's less wholesome areas. A winking red light caught my eye, and I glanced down the side street. Crime scene. The yellow tape was already up, and several cruisers were nosed into a hurried splay. It's him again, I thought. And even before I knew what I meant by that, I was swinging the car down the street to the crime scene. Where are we going? Rita asked, quite reasonably. I said, I'd like to check here and see if they need me. Don't you have a beeper? I gave her my best Friday night smile. They don't always know they need me, I said. I might have stopped anyway to show off Rita. The whole point of wearing a disguise was to be seen wearing her. But in truth, the small, irresistible voice yammering in my ear would have made me stop no matter what. It's him again. And I had to see what he was up to. I left Rita in the car and hurried over. He was up to no good again, the rascal. There was the same stack of neatly wrapped body parts. Angel no relation bent over it in almost the same position he'd been in when I left him at the last scene. Hijo de puta, he said when I approached him. Not me, I trust, I said. The rest of us are complaining that we have to work on Friday night, Angel said. You show up with a date, and there is still nothing for you here. Same guy, same pattern? Same, he said. He flipped the plastic away with his pen. Bone dry again, he said. No blood at all. The words made me feel slightly lightheaded. I leaned in for a look. Once again, the body parts were amazingly clean and dry. They had a near-blue tinge to them and seemed preserved in their small, perfect moment of time. Wonderful. A small difference in the cuts this time, Angel said. In 4 places. He pointed. Very rough here, almost emotional. Then here, not so much. Here and here, in between, huh? Very nice, I said. And then look at this, he said. He nudged aside the bloodless chunk on top with a pencil. Underneath, another piece gleamed white. The flesh had been flayed off very carefully, lengthwise, to reveal a clean bone. Why would he do like that? Angel asked softly. I breathed. He's experimenting, I said, trying to find the right way. And I stared at the neat, dry section until I became aware that Angel had been looking at me for a very long moment. Like a kid playing with his food, is how I described it to Rita when I returned to the car. My God, Rita said, that's horrible. I think the correct word is heinous, I said. How can you joke about it, Dexter? I gave her a reassuring smile. You kind of get used to it in my line of work, I said. We all make jokes to hide our pain. Well, good Lord, I hope they catch this maniac soon. I thought of the neatly stacked body parts, the variety of the cuts, the wonderful total lack of blood. Not too soon, I said. What did you say? She asked. I said, I don't think it will be too soon. The killer is extremely clever, and the detective in charge of the case is more interested in playing politics than in solving murders. She looked at me to see if I was kidding. Then she sat quietly for a while as we drove south on US 1. She didn't speak until South Miami. I can never get used to seeing, I don't know, the underside, the way things really are, the way you see it, she finally said. She took me by surprise.
I had been using the silence to think about the nicely stacked body parts we had just left. My mind had been hungrily circling the clean, dry, chopped-up limbs like an eagle looking for a chunk of meat to rip out. Rita's observation was so unexpected I couldn't even stutter for a minute. "What do you mean?" I managed to say at last. She frowned. I'm not sure. Just, we all assume that things really are a certain way, the way they're supposed to be. And then they never are. They're always more, I don't know, darker? More human. Like this. I'm thinking, of course, the detective wants to catch the killer. Isn't that what detectives do? And it never occurred to me before that there could be anything at all political about murder. Practically everything, I said. I turned onto her street and slowed down in front of her neat and unremarkable house. But you, she said. She didn't seem to notice where we were or what I had said. That's where you start. Most people would never really think it through that far. I'm not all that deep, Rita, I said. I nudged the car into park. It's like everything really is two ways, the way we all pretend it is and the way it really is. And you already know that, and it's like a game for you. I had no idea what she was trying to say. In truth, I had given up trying to figure it out, and as she spoke, I'd let my mind wander back to the newest murder, the cleanness of the flesh, the improvisational quality of the cuts, the complete, dry, spotless, immaculate lack of blood. Dexter, Rita said. She put a hand on my arm. I kissed her. I don't know which one of us was more surprised. It really wasn't something I had thought about doing ahead of time, and it certainly wasn't her perfume, but I mashed my lips against hers and held them there for a long moment. She pushed away. No, she said. I know, Dexter. All right, I said, still shocked at what I had done. I don't think I want to. I'm not ready for. Damn it, Dexter, she said. She unclipped her seatbelt, opened the car door, and ran into her house. Oh, dear, I thought. What on earth have I done now? And I knew I should be wondering about that, and perhaps feeling disappointed that I had just destroyed my disguise after a year and a half of hard maintenance. But all I could